Today we start a new series. This will actually be a series of serieses. So over the next, 5 months? All right, each month we'll look at a new biblical figure. I'm calling the series Biblical Bios, just because it's an excuse for us to stay in the Word, and I think it's interesting to take sort of a close look at some of the biblical figures. It's also of interest to me, just because I find the lives of these people interesting, and in particular what they can teach us about faith and faithfulness and all that good stuff. One challenge, of course, that we have with a series like this is there isn't a whole lot of figures in the Bible for whom we have enough information to provide a biography. And even someone like Abraham, we don't really meet him until he's like 90 years old. And if you actually piece together his narrative, we actually don't get much about him. We get even less about Isaac. We get a little bit more about Jacob, though it's still kind of in a narrow window. Characters about whom we get an actual biography, something that resembles like information about their life from young age to old age, are relatively rare. Joseph in the Old Testament is one of them, so not to be confused with the father of Jesus, about whom we have almost no information whatsoever. Joseph gets quite a bit of a story, in fact, the most of any patriarch in the Old Testament, interestingly enough. King David gets quite a bit of a story. Jeremiah gets quite a bit of a story of all the prophets. He's the most autobiographical in his letter. Isaiah doesn't tell us very much about his own personal life. Ezekiel doesn't tell us much, other than that he was really weird. Jeremiah tells us quite a bit. There's all kinds of narrative digressions in his prophecy. Ah, college students, welcome. We get a little bit about Daniel. We know a little bit about his formation from childhood to adulthood. Moving into the New Testament, we have, again, only got a handful of figures, Jesus being, of course, one of them. The Apostle Paul, we actually can reconstruct a good part of his life, certainly after his conversion. This series is going to be, I hope, a little more laid back than in the past. So I'm going to involve a lot more questions to y'all and conversation, I hope. Please bring your Bibles for this series. It'll be very important for you guys to have them with you so we can read the passages together. So in the future, if you don't have them today, no problem, but do try and bring them. For this series, we'll be looking at six figures. The first figure we'll be looking at is Joseph. For the next 3 weeks, we're looking at the patriarch Joseph from the book of Genesis. We'll be looking at David, who's one of my favorite figures in the biblical story. And David's got a lot. We'll have to skip a lot about him if we're just going to do it in 3 weeks. And then for 1 month, we're actually going to do women of the Bible. There isn't any woman in the Bible, unfortunately, who we have enough information about to do a whole biography, which is a bit of a bummer. But there's lots of women in the Bible who play very pivotal roles at crucial stages of salvation history. And so for 1 month, we're going to look at three different women, one each week. We'll look at Hannah, who is the mother of Samuel. We'll look at Abigail, who's one of David's wives, and she plays a pretty crucial role in his rise to becoming king. And then we'll look at Mary, the mother of our Lord. We don't have a whole lot about her, but what we do have about her is tantalizing and interesting. We will be limiting ourselves to the biblical data on Mary. We're not going to be using that apocryphal stuff that's used to defend all kinds of weird doctrines about her. We'll stick to the biblical text. And then the last figure we'll look at is the Apostle Paul. And again, with him, we'll be focusing primarily on his life after his conversion, though we can say a little bit about his life before that. So that's Joseph, the patriarch, David, Paul, and then three women, Hannah, Abigail, and Mary. In the 3 weeks right before Lent, so during the pre-Lenten season, I think is when I have it lined up, we'll actually take a break from the series and do a three-week series on the liturgy of Holy Communion. We'll be walking through that together and seeing how it works and why it has in it what it has. Okay, so any questions about that, or any figure in the Bible you really just want to learn a lot about that's not listed here? The Bible. You know, I'm not basing this series off of anything like that, so I don't really. There's been a number of books about David. I would avoid any sort of modern biography of him, it's almost certainly going to be written by a critical scholar. And oh man, there's been several attempts to like retell the story of David in like a modern guise over the last. I think David's really fascinating. I mean, he doesn't get anywhere near as much attention as he deserves. And his life is provocative in more than one way. And particularly the narrative of Samuel, we'll get into this when we get to David, but on its face, it's a story about how he becomes king. But underneath that, if you look at the details of it, it's not about how David becomes king. That's not all it's about. It would be more accurate to say it's about how God makes David king. Because you see God plays a relatively minor role in the narrative in terms of just the number of verses where God's an actor. But the number of times that God is clearly at work, or that David is clearly understanding that this has to be up to God, that defines the action of the narrative is very, very interesting. Yeah.
I mean, somebody comes to mind as Moses.
Moses is another character that would be very interesting to follow.
I mean, because maybe arguably David, but I mean, Moses, I think, is in the Jewish tradition, right? Like, the greatest prophet. I mean, he is the greatest man.
Sure. Right, right. So Moses would.
There's a priority in that Jewish tradition.
Yeah, and I decided not to do Moses.
I mean, I'm totally fine.
Yeah, it's fine. I'm trying to remember my thought process here. Why I remember thinking about doing Moses and then not doing him. As soon as you do Moses, you can't avoid issues of like the law and I didn't want to get into the weeds on that stuff, just because that could take a whole semester by itself. Anyway, my focus on this is going to be a bit more devotional in character rather than technical, though of course it's me, so I won't avoid that stuff altogether. We're not going to be getting too into the weeds on like particulars of texts and all that stuff. We're going to be looking at their lives. Obviously the biblical text is our base. But trying to learn what we can about their lives. So one thing I'm not going to be doing as much or focusing as much on, though again it'll come up, is in particular the way in which these particular figures advance the story of Scripture itself. I mean, that'll come up, obviously, because that's part of their story. I'm going to be looking at more, what can we learn from these figures about what it means to be obedient or faithful or to endure suffering or whatever, which isn't always necessarily the primary point of the narratives that we'll be reading. I won't be going beyond the text, obviously. I'll be saying what I think the text allows us to say, but I'm not going to necessarily be unpacking these stories within the story of salvation as such, if that makes sense. Looking more just at their lives, what we can learn from their example. One major caveat to that, though, is that in addition to asking the question, what can we learn about faith or faithfulness or obedience in the lives of these figures, I will also want to ask every single time we engage a figure, how does this figure prefigure Jesus? Because Jesus consistently reads the Old Testament in terms of himself. And part of the power of the narratives of these figures is in the way in which they do prefigure Christ. And so we will be delving into that a little bit. So those are the two major questions I'm going to be always asking. What can we learn about what faith in God looks like from this person? I use that language, what faith looks like. We talk about faith a lot in the church and the need to have faith. But one thing we don't always do as well, and I'm guilty of this as well, is talking about what faith might prompt someone to actually do in any given situation. Like, what kind of behavior does faith motivate in the lives of these figures? And so we'll be looking at that. And then how do each of these figures in their own way and certain episodes in their life prefigure Jesus? Because I think they all do in very, very cool ways. The first figure is Joseph, not to be confused with the father of Jesus. This is the patriarch Joseph. His story is recounted in Genesis 37 and then 39 through 50. What's interesting about that is that Joseph occupies a larger chunk of Genesis than any other figure. And arguably, we know more about the biography of Joseph than we do even about Moses. We know very little about Moses till he becomes the head of Israel. And even then, his life is always very clearly within the context of how Israel's doing. So Joseph gets, 13 chapters of Genesis? I mean, Abraham doesn't get that much. So he gets the bulk of the book in some crucial ways. His narrative serves as a hinge between the life of the patriarchs and the Exodus. He, of course, answers the crucial question. You know, they're in Canaan. How do they get to Egypt? If God's going to lead them out of Egypt in Exodus, how do they get there? They don't start out there. Abraham's in what we now call Israel or Palestine. So is Isaac and so is Jacob. So Joseph answers that question. Remember that in Genesis 15, God makes a covenant with Abraham and then says to him that I can't give your descendants this land yet. They have to sojourn in Egypt as slaves for 400 years, and then I will lead them out and deliver them and lead them into the promised land. So part of the promise is that they have to not be in the Holy Land for a bit, that they have to be in Egypt. And so the narrative of Joseph sets up how they get there. The narrative of Joseph also sets up how they multiply and how they become a great nation, just in terms of numbers. The story of Joseph also illustrates the process of forging the patriarchal generation to be the people of promise. So when God finds Abraham, Abraham's an idolater. He worships idols. 1 Samuel tells us that. So God reveals himself to Abraham. He's the only person in the world that has any real knowledge of God at that point. God tends to work as he works with us, slowly. So how do you form a people that are attentive to God as God? God as creator, God as redeemer. We see some of those dynamics playing out in the life of Joseph in terms of the way God forms him. And also, interestingly enough, the story of Joseph highlights in many ways how the blessing of God can be intermingled with sin and rivalry and deception and all the nitty-gritties of human life. So those are some of the big ideas. The first thing we got to do tonight, though, before we get into the weeds with Joseph, is get into the background by asking the question, whose son is he? Where does he come in the lineup? Well, he's the son of Jacob. Jacob is the son of Isaac. Isaac is the son of Abraham. So he's Abraham's great-grandson, right? Jacob being Abraham's grandson. In order to appreciate the significance of this, we have to do a quick rundown of his father, Jacob. You remember that Jacob, who's Abraham's grandson, had the hots for a young woman named Rachel. And he agreed to work for Rachel's father, Laban, for 7 years in order to win her hand. Laban, I'm going to need more room than that, probably. I'll move her over. Laban agrees to this. Rachel, however, is the younger of Laban's two daughters, and it's not custom to marry off the younger daughter before you marry off the old. So on the day of the wedding, Laban tricks Jacob, gets him drunk, marries him to Leah instead, who the narrative kind of tells us is ugly. No offense, Leah. You're not ugly. Leah in the Bible is apparently ugly. Jacob was not at all pleased with this. So he agrees to work for another 7 years, again, since it's 14 years total now, to get Rachel, then he gets to marry Rachel too. So he's married to both of them. Rachel and Leah don't like each other, though, and it becomes obvious quickly why. Jacob likes Rachel more than he likes Leah, right? And she picks up on this. After doing the marital deed with both of them, Rachel doesn't have any children. She's throughout most of the bulk of the narrative in Genesis 30, she's barren. But Leah has Reuben. That's number one. Then she has Simeon. He's number two. Then she has Levi. That's number three. And then she has Judah, her first four sons. Rachel is caught and bothered by this. She tells Jacob that if she doesn't have a son, she will die. And so she gives to her husband her maidservant, Bilna, to, you know, do the deed with. And she immediately has number five, Dan. And then she has number six, Naphtali. Leah gets bothered by this. She sees Rachel's overtaking her, though not really by much. So she gives Jacob her servant, Zipporah. And she has number 7, Gad, and number 8, Asher. Well, then Leah starts getting productive again, and she has number 8. Yes, number 9, Issachar, and then Zebulun is number 10, and then she has Dinah, number 11, a daughter. So these are, if you know your Bible story, these are the tribes of Israel that are being born here. Well, then finally, God opens up Rachel's womb, and she has Joseph. Joseph is her first son. He's number 12. Well, Dinah's 11, so he's the 12th born to Jacob. Joseph's name means he may add. So Genesis 30, 22 to 24 says, "Then God remembered Rachel, and God listened to her and opened her womb. She conceived and bore a son and said, 'God has taken away, which is Asef, my reproach.' And she called him Yosef, saying, 'May the Lord add Yosef Yahweh to me another son.'" So his name literally means, "May the Lord add," or may he add, Yosef. But it sounds an awful lot like Asef, "taken away my shame." Because, of course, for a woman in this culture, having sons is what ensures her long-term security after her husband dies. Particularly in a context like this, there's a rivalry between them. There's no reason to expect any of these guys would take care of her if something were to happen to Jacob. So a woman's livelihood is very much dependent on whether or not she can produce a child in this culture. So that's why she's very excited now about Joseph. God does hear her, and then gives her Benjamin, as number 13. Unfortunately, she dies giving birth to Benjamin. And when Benjamin's born, she wants to name him Ben-Oni, which means son of my sorrow. But Jacob names him Ben-Yamin, which means son of my right hand. So remember that for ancient Israelites, the name tells you an awful lot about the person and certainly their parents' expectations for them. So here we have Benjamin being named by his father, son of my right hand, born to his favorite wife, the woman he's been pining after all those years when God stuck him with Leah, God/Laban. What's the significance of this name, son of my right hand? What does that mean? What's it mean to be at someone's right hand?
Your favorite one, the number one guy.
Yeah, why do you say that?
Well, that's always the position that the most trusted servant.
Okay, the most exalted position is at the right hand of the master, right? That's true. Sitting at the right hand of somebody. And we see this language applied to our Lord, actually. Psalm 110, which is a psalm about the king of Israel. In that psalm, God is described as seating the king at his right hand to rule with God. And this is overwhelmingly applied to Jesus in the New Testament. Matthew 26:64, Ephesians 1:20, Colossians 3:1, Hebrews 1:3, 8:1, 10:12, 12:3, I think. Jesus is described as sitting at the right hand of the Father. And we use that language in our creed. He ascended into heaven and is seated at the right hand of the Father. And he's depicted as sitting at the right hand of the Father, or in some cases as just sitting on the Father's throne in the book of Revelation. So it's a place of honor. It's a tantamount to sitting in the king's own seat and co-leading with him, and so much more so in the household. So clearly the way he's treating his sons, Jacob, is indicating that he favors them over his other sons. In the same chapter, after Benjamin is born and Rachel dies, Isaac also dies, and Jacob and Esau bury him together. So it's a tough year for Jacob. His favorite wife dies. At this point, he's an old man. Joseph and Benjamin are all he's got left of his favorite wife. This is a very important context for the story. I'm taking the time to unpack it because it's huge, these details. And it's not even just at the beginning. with the rivalry that we're going to see between Jacob and his brother, or Joseph and his brothers. It continues to pay dividends as the story advances to know these details. It's also interesting that Jacob would allow this reality to play out, since he knows all about sibling rivalry, right? I mean, what does Jacob know about sibling rivalry? Where does he... He stole Esau's birthright. And what did Esau do?
He asked for stew.
What happened when Esau found out Jacob took his birthright? Tried to kill him, right? So Jacob flees. The whole reason he meets Laban and wants to marry his daughters at all is because he's in exile. He's pissed off his brother Esau, taking his birthright. Jacob's also the youngest. Esau's the older of the two. So by definition, in this culture, the elder brother always gets the more significant inheritance, always gets the prerogative on the father's estate. And so Jacob swindles him out of his inheritance, which is a big deal. Jacob all knows all about the discord that can be caused by a younger brother upsetting the hierarchy, upsetting the way things are. He knows this at this point very well. And he seems to have learned little about the way he treats his own sons. Okay. Let's get into the story. Genesis 37. Okay. So, first little interludes here. Jacob lived in the land of his father's sojourning, in the land of Canaan. So, they're in Palestine, modern-day Palestine. These are the generations of Jacob. Now, remember how the book of Genesis is divided into these genealogies, the Toledot in Hebrew. These are the generations. The book starts that way, Genesis 2. These are the generations of Abraham. Now we're seeing a whole new narrative chunk. It's the last narrative chunk of Genesis starting here. These are the generations of Jacob. So it's now telling us about Jacob's children. And the overwhelming thrust of the narrative is on Joseph. Though Judah will also play a significant role, as we will see. Okay. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah. So these four. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved, now remember Israel and Jacob are the same person. Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a robe with many colors. And when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. All right, a lot going on here already. What do we learn about Joseph from this? He's a tattletale. He's a snitch. He's a rat, right? There's already the rivalry these brothers are gonna have internalized between their own mothers, right? That's sort of a foregone conclusion. That it's already a tinderbox waiting to go off. And Joseph's adroit diplomatic contribution to this tectonic problem is to stick a stick in the bee's nest, right? So he's a troublemaker. In some sense, he takes after his father, right? Maybe that's why Jacob likes him the most, because he sees himself in him. So Joseph's a snitch. What else we know about him from this passage?
A bit of a dandy.
What makes you say that? What makes you say that?
With his fancy coat and all.
You guys have all heard of Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat. It's a sort of a mildly iconoclastic play about Joseph. I say iconoclastic because it's not very faithful to the biblical narrative. This technicolored thing is unfortunate because for some reason the Greek and the Latin versions of the Old Testament translated this Hebrew word as multicolored. I can't give the word to you, unfortunately, but I'm told in the commentaries I read to prepare for tonight's lesson that multicolored in Greek could just mean embroidered, like richly ornate. And so in that case, we have the Latin to blame for just thoroughly butchering the crap out of this word. Because the Latin, of course, is being translated from the Greek and not from the Hebrew. So they're going off of the Greek. So any sort of nuance the Greek picks up with Greek that's not necessarily in the Hebrew, the Latin's missing it even more. What the word actually means literally in Hebrew is just palms or soles of feet. So it describes the uttermost extremity of your extremities. And so one way that scholars have translated this in sort of critical editions of this text is that his robe was long-hemmed. He had a long-hemmed robe. It went down to the palms of his hands and down to the ankles, or down to the, you know, down to the very bottom of his feet. One theory I've heard about this is that there's some evidence that symbolically one's inheritance would be sewn into, like symbolically sewn into the bottom of the hem of your outer garment. And the bigger the hem, the more the booty, right, is the idea. And that Jacob's got long hems. Joseph, right, I keep mixing those names up. Feel free to call me out when I do that. So Joseph's got a long-hemmed or richly embroidered coat. Whatever the details about why this was a symbol in this age, at the very least, it's very obvious what this means, other than his being a dandy.
In addition to the fact that he has the ear of his father.
Or he's the heir of his father.
Yeah.
The ear.
Of his father.
Yeah.
He's making reports about other sons.
Right.
To his father.
Yeah. Yeah, so he's a snitch. He's also got the inside track with his dad. What else?
He's a shepherd.
He's a shepherd. Yep. Of course, they all are.
That'll be important, especially when he becomes.
Sure. Right. As the story progresses.
Also, a bit of an age difference between the older.
Sure. I mean, he's 17 when the story starts. Right.
But the older one especially.
I mean, so he's a lot younger than his older brothers. And again, in a culture where the older always has the privilege or the prerogative, the fact that Joseph would have his father's ear, that Joseph would have his father's favor, that Joseph would have the sign of his favor in this like sort of flamboyant robe, this is really just upsetting this very delicate balance. And again, Joseph is not. Neither Jacob or Joseph really are helping this at all, right? So what's the result of all of this? The passage tells us. He's got his father's ear. He's a snitch.
He can't talk to him peaceably.
Yeah.
They just fight with him all the time.
Well, they haven't fought with him yet, but we have the reasons to believe they will. What have we been seeing so far? What do his brothers think about him? We now know for sure. They hate him. His brothers hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. You said they couldn't speak to each other. Okay. Tinderbox situation. Now Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Hear this dream that I have dreamed. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field. And behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright, and behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf." His brothers said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us, or are you indeed to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Then he dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Behold, I have dreamed another dream. Behold, the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars were bowing down to me." But when he told to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow ourselves down to the ground before you?" And his brothers were jealous of him, but his fathers kept the saying in mind. Okay, what have we learned about him now? Hey, he's got dreams. And he brags about him. Let's start with just the first thing, right? What might it tell us about Joseph that he's having these sort of future predicting dreams? Yeah, he's got God's ear too, it seems, at least partially. What else?
He's
If you guys knew somebody who was being given messages by God in dreams, what would you think about their relationship with God?
Like maybe close.
Close, yeah. What do you guys think? Nothing? Prophet. He's a prophet. Yeah, sure, because he's getting insight into the way things are going to go. We normally associate the prophets with, you know, mighty deeds and the anointing of the Holy Spirit and God's favor. And so Jacob's got some spiritual gifts, it seems, right? Pretty powerful ones, right? Okay, what's he do with these dreams? This mighty spiritual gift that God gives to him generously, graciously. He tells people about it. With what kind of spirit do you suppose he tells them about it? Yeah?
It could be bragging.
It could
just be that he had a dream and thought he should tell them.
Yeah?
But the outcome of it is that he alienates his family even more.
Sure, sure. And other than the alienation of his family, do you have other reasons for thinking that he's bragging? That's what he's doing? Blake?
He's setting himself above them.
Sure.
I think they're going to
bow down. Yeah, Blake? He's brazen about it.
Probably bragging.
Yeah. I admit that there is some ambiguity in the text. I think one crucial piece of evidence that he is, in fact, bragging is that his father rebukes him for it. I mean, you think if he had spoken to his father quietly, you know, his father could just...
I feel like there's some examples of people hearing God's proclamation that they're going to be this great person, and they're like... No,
they don't want to have anything to do with it.
Not me, no.
Yeah, right, right. Interesting insight, Blake. I think you're onto something there. Right, I mean, that's Moses' reaction, and Moses is described as the meekest man who ever lived in the Old Testament, right? Humble. So here we have young upstart 17-year-old Joseph giving these dreams, and... Hey, guys. Yeah, yeah. He's a teenager, man, in every way. Okay. His brothers hate him. I mean, the text goes out of its way. It's now said to us three times that they hate him. And a fourth time they say they're jealous of him because he has his father's love more than this. Now, his brothers hate him. What's interesting is that Jacob's not, I mean, he rebukes Joseph, but he doesn't actually, like, do anything to, you know, help pacify this at all. So the narrative progresses. Jacob sends Joseph to tend the sheep with his brothers, who are kind of doing it a ways. If you're herders, of course, you have to find wherever there's enough grass for the sheep to eat, so you're mobile. And so at one point in the narrative, the brothers are all off. Joseph's with his father. His father sends Joseph to go find his brothers. So then, as he finds his brothers see him from a distance. This is verse 18 of chapter 37. They saw him from afar, and before he could come near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him in one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams." So this is pretty bitter language. You know, they're mocking him for being a dreamer. You know, they've got this nickname for him. Here comes this dreamer. And then they're shoving it in his face. Let's see what happened to his dreams now. You know, they're not happy. To say the least. But when Reuben heard it, now Reuben's the elder brother from Leah's, so he's the elder brother of all of them. To say anything about being the elder brother of Leah's sons. But when Reuben heard of it, Reuben heard of it, he rescued him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood, throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him." And then that's the end of the quote. The writer gives us some more information, that he might rescue him out of their hand to restore him to his father. So the idea here is that after they throw Joseph down in there and they sort of laugh about it and leave, Reuben's going to sneak back and rescue his brother and take him back to his dad. We have to admire Reuben's chutzpah and all this. He's got some courage opposing his brothers, but his courage has a little bit of a limit. He's not willing to actually put the kibosh on the entire plan. Obviously, his intention is to rescue his brother, Joseph, his half-brother. So he's not interested, so it seems, in doing anything to Joseph. But he lets his brothers get away with some stuff. And then, as we'll see, Reuben doesn't do anything to stop what happens next. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, and the robe of many colors that he wore. And they took him and threw him into a pit. And the pit was empty. There was no water in it. So they're throwing him into a dry well. Interesting, this narrative detail here. They stripped him of his robe. That's what he was dandying about. You know, look how special I am. They rip it off of him, right? They disrobe him. A little bit of a prefiguring of Christ here and how he has his own garment stripped from him. One of the ways you would dishonor somebody in the ancient world would be to steal their clothing. Archbishop Thomas Cranmer, this continues to pay dividends for us culturally. When Queen Mary came to the throne and reestablished the Church of England's loyalty to the Church of Rome, she didn't want to just kill Thomas Cranmer because he had been consecrated an archbishop by the Pope before he, you know, became Protestant. So he was legitimately ordained. And so Queen Mary went through, staged a process of his formal deprivation. And the climax of that process was in a large church in front of a crowd of people. Thomas Cranmer formally, disavowing his heresies, his Protestant heresies. And then he was formally stripped of his archiepiscopal regalia in front of the entire congregation. So this is one way you knock someone down a few pegs, is by taking off of them, the signs of their dignity. So stripping him of his garments. So they rip off his robe, they throw him in the pit. Then they sat down to eat. This is a pretty awful detail, right? Because they've just thrown him in the pit, and now they're just sitting there eating while their brother's down in this pit. It's like, the details of the narrative make it pretty clear that they're like eating by the pit. Like they're right there. And so it's almost like they're rubbing it in his face that they've like went up to him or something. I mean, what do you guys think? Am I reading too much into this? Right, right.
So, I mean, I can just see, fury is boiling over.
Yeah. For Joseph or for his brothers?
The fury of Joseph's brothers towards
Joseph. Right, right.
Such that, they wanted to
taunt him. They're rubbing it in. Kicking him while he's down. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's borne out by the narrative as we proceed. And looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and let our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." That's so big of you, Judah. And his brothers listened to him. Then Midianite traders passed by, and they drew up Joseph, lifted him out of the pit, and they sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. They took Joseph to Egypt. Now Reuben goes back to the pit, sees that he's not there, tears his robes. They take Joseph's multicolored or long-hemmed robe, they rip it to pieces, they douse it in goat's blood, they give it to their father and say, "Look, we found this. We found this." Reuben doesn't admit the truth. Yeah, I mean, he goes along with this scheme at one level. It sounds like maybe he wasn't there when they decided to sell him, because he does go back to the, obviously, if he knew that he wasn't there, why would he go back? But he doesn't tell his father what happened. He goes along with the story that they found his robe in the wilderness all torn up and bloody. Implication being that he was eaten by a wild animal or something. So Jacob laments. Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, "No, I shall go down to Sheol to my son mourning." Thus his father wept for him. In the meantime, the Midianites sold Joseph to an Egyptian officer named Potiphar. Okay. So there's every indication that Joseph can overhear their plotting and planning from the bottom of the well. And in fact, later in the narrative, we know for a fact that he begs for his life, though it doesn't record that here. In 42:21, We'll get to this part of the narrative in due course, but Reuben recounts to his brothers years later his memory of the event, and he says, and Reuben answered them, "Did I not tell you not to sin against the boy? But you did not listen, so now there comes..." The brothers are talking to each other. It's not Reuben who's... "In truth, we are guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us, and we did not listen. This is why this distress has come upon us." So he begged for his life. His brothers had no pity. Okay. Let's move on so we can just have some time for discussion at the end here. He's sold to Potiphar. We skip over, there's the whole chapter now with Judah and Tamar, which we'll skip, but it does bear on the narrative. Judah, remember, just keep in mind over the next 3 weeks what Judah's role is so far in the story. And it was his idea to sell Joseph into slavery. So Judah, it's his idea to sell him to Egypt. Judah's got a role to play in all this. You know, he's the primary agent of Joseph's subsequent suffering, inasmuch as all that happens after this is because it was Judah's idea to sell him. Slightly better than killing him. Sure. Right. Though, again, a life of slavery, I mean, maybe it would have been better to kill him. I don't know. I mean, obviously, we know how the story goes. We know how the story plays out, but... Judah's guilty of all of this. Judah himself experiences some growth as the narrative progresses, and we'll look at that in the third week. Okay. Now, chapter 39, we learn something new about Joseph. Now, Joseph had been brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, so he's a very senior figure in the Egyptian hierarchy, had bought him from the Ishmaelites. Verse 2, "The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his Egyptian master. His master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. So Joseph found favor in his sight and attended him, and he made him overseer of his house and put him in charge of all that he had. From the time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house and Joseph, for Joseph's sake. The blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house of the field." So he left all that he had in Joseph's charge, and because of him, he had no concern about anything but the food that he ate. This guy's put Joseph in charge of his whole house, and the narrative tells us that he didn't bother with anything, because whatever Joseph did prospered. We learned something else about Joseph, though. Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. He's not a dandy anymore. He's a stud. Right? So much of a stud that Potiphar's wife starts having a lazy eye, right? Look at that piece of meat over there, man. I got to get me some of that. So she tries to seduce him. She provokes him. Lie with me, right? Joseph won't have anything to do with this. Now, it's interesting. Joseph says, "How could my master has entrusted me with all this. How could I betray his trusts?" Joseph is honoring his senior in this story, right? He won't go back on his master. This is a development for Joseph, right? Honoring the order of things, honoring the hierarchy, paying heed to who his superiors are, right? Why is that significant? How does that suggest he's maybe grown a little bit by this little excursion of his into Egypt? Right. Right. This whole thing is because he's upstarting. I mean, he's telling all his elder brothers and his father and mother are going to bow down to him. So clearly, as a 17-year-old little precocious kid, he's got no respect for the proper order of things. You know, he's happy to tell all his brothers are going to bow down to him. He tells even his father that. Right? So it seems like he's learned a little bit of a lesson. He's been humbled a bit. Because now all of a sudden we see him honoring his senior, which is exactly what he didn't do that got him into this mess in the first place. So he seems to be growing a bit, maybe. He's also got pretty high standards morally. He won't sleep with his master's wife. But she continues to seduce him and seduce him and seduce him. Then it comes to a head. But one day, when he went into the house, this is verse 11, to do his work, and none of the men of the house were there in the house, she caught him by the garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. And as soon as she saw that he left his garment in her hand and had fled out of the house, she called to the men of the household and said to them, "See, he has brought among us a Hebrew to laugh at us. He came in to me," which is a euphemism for sex, "to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And as soon as he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried out, he left his garment beside me and fled and got out of the house. Then she laid up his garment by her until his master came home." Right? So she's, what is she doing by laying hold of the garment until her husband gets home? Abigail, what's she doing? Keeping the evidence, right? This is her story. The fact that she's got Joseph's garment is the evidence that he had come into her. Right? Of course, we know what really happens, but it's pretty damning evidence if you don't know what happens. So she's holding on to the evidence. Her master comes home. "The Hebrew servant whom you have bought among us came into me to laugh at me. But as soon as I lifted up my voice and cried, he left his garment beside me and fled out of the house." As soon as his master heard these words that his wife spoke to him, and Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, the place of the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. Is there any parallel between what's happening to Joseph right now and what's already happened to him, narratively, in terms of the details? His clothing gets him into trouble, right? He's stripped of his clothing. I think that's significant. Anytime the biblical narrative gives you a detail like that, you have to ask, why is it telling me this? Because you'll notice that it often omits a lot of what we normally would expect as modern readers to want to hear about. So whenever it gives you detail, like pay attention, he's being stripped again, right? And he's stripped before and becomes the favored son, now becomes a slave. And now you think that's pretty low. He can go lower still. He's stripped again and then becomes a prisoner. And once again, the robe is used as evidence about what's happened. Right, so he's really being shorn here. This is about as far down as he can go. And in both cases, his deprivation, his humiliation, is symbolized by the fact that he's stripped naked. Right? In one case, it's because he's flaunting this robe about. In another case, it's because he's being righteous and trying to flee. But in other words, don't leave your clothes behind at a lady's house for any reason. If you're going swimming in her pool, it's totally innocent. Get all your clothes before you leave, all right? That's the moral of this story. Interesting thing, though, but the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the house, keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it succeed. Okay. How do we square the fact that God is with Joseph with the fact that Joseph is suffering the way he is? I think that's the major tension of this narrative. Because now we know for sure that God is with Joseph. He's now told us twice, and that God is giving Joseph favor with people who are over him, and that it's causing all of the work that he's doing to succeed. And yet, normally when we think about God's blessing on somebody, what do we think of? What does that person's life look like? Marshalls, what do you think, when someone's being blessed by God, what do you expect to see?
Buying Lamborghinis.
Buying Lamborghinis, right? What about you, Marsha? What do you think?
Oh, I just saw it looks rosy from the outside.
Looks rosy from the outside, right? Their life is going well. And it's interesting, this approach to life continues even for the biblical writers. Even in Jesus' day, they associated one's prosperity with their blessing from God. And Jesus is always flabbergasted by this conclusion they're coming to, because that's not how it plays out here again and again and again. Not even just once or twice, but often with the major figures of the biblical story. God's with them, and yet. So how do we square this? I'm putting it to you guys. I don't have an answer to this question, but I just
of it is God moves people into a place that he needs them to be.
Mm-hmm.
If Joseph hadn't been in the prison, he wouldn't be able to have helped Egypt at that time.
Sure.
And then all of the things.
Yeah, so you're looking forward to the story and seeing how it ends, for sure. And that's part of that's certainly part of the puzzle, that whenever we're going through some hardship of some kind, we don't know what God's up to necessarily.
It's easy to be faithful when things are going well.
Why is that?
Because
sure.
Character development.
Sure. Builds character. Calvin's dad asks him to shovel the walk because it builds character. You know, the Bible, interestingly, has a sort of ambivalent attitude about what wealth and prosperity means. On occasion, it does speak in terms of God blessing, that you get these things because God's blessing you with them. But right before Israel goes into the Holy Land, I wish I had written this passage down. I'm not going to be able to find it. He warns Israel about their prosperity in the Holy Land. Does anybody remember what God warns them about there? I mean, he's leading them into the land of milk and honey. It's language that poetically talks about how just abundant the land is. They're going to be prosperous there. They're going to have crops and herds that multiply and grow. Right, and why might they? Right. We think we did it. Americans, I think, are particularly susceptible to this. And not necessarily for entirely bad reasons. We do live in a culture where social mobility, that is the ability to move up the social ladder from lower class to upper class, it's still hard. It's hard in any culture, but in the United States at least, it's a lot easier than it has been in most other cultures around the world historically. And so one really can improve their lot if they work hard. Not always, but certainly more frequently than in other cultures around the world. And so we really have associated hard work and one's own character and work ethic with success in our culture. They saw it as a sign of God's blessing, but we can confuse our success with our own independence. You got something else to say, Blake?
Yeah. Look at the moral development that Joseph, the maturity that Joseph developed and displayed, and there have been no marks left on his soul that will be carried on.
Right. You might say he's materially poor, but spiritually rich. Yeah. I mean, if he's maturing, I can only assume he's maturing even more. I mean, at some level, there's more to the story, and we're not reading it tonight. So we can assume that there's, at the very least, he's going to be positioned for what happens next. Which is what you said. You're right.
That's what I feel like. First one is probably more of the equivalent.
He thrust into a position where he has
all
of the wealth of Egypt,
It's interesting that you mentioned that, Blake, because as the story unfolds, we'll find that his success in the following chapter has entirely to do with the gift that God gave him to divine dreams. And so, in very real effect, all that Joseph has left to him now is the gift that God had given him at the beginning.
Like, would you be in a position to be a
not? And I think, to your point, Tripp, why the second deprivation? It just occurred to me just now. Especially in light of the fact that it's his ability to dream dreams that gets him out of his tough spot the second time around. That's God's gift to him. That's supernatural ability. That's all he's got left. He's got nothing left but what God has given him. He's got no earthly provision of any kind. He's got no earthly power of any kind. I mean, even as a slave in Potiphar's house, I mean, the head slaves of prominent officials, don't think like antebellum American South, you know, chattel slavery, you know, getting whipped every day and stuff. These guys were powerful people. And I mean, I don't know about Egyptian law, but in Roman law, they could conduct business for their master. They could sign legally binding contracts for their master if they were in that position. So even as a slave in Potiphar's house, he's still got quite a bit of worldly influence. I mean, now the only person that pays any attention to him is the jailer. That's not worth a whole lot. So he's been stripped down to nothing. All he's got is what God has given him. And we'll see this theme recurrent again and again in the biblical narrative. You've already seen it before now. I mean, God told Abraham that he would have a son. He wasn't having any. Well, how about my servant? No, it'll be your own flesh and born son. Okay, well then Sarah tries to, she's barren, so she gives it to Abraham, to, you know, her, to Hagar, her maid. God says, no, it'll be from Sarah too, but Sarah's barren. I mean, the whole narrative is just drenched with, this is happening only because God wants to happen. Yeah, when a man and a woman get together, they make a child. But in Abraham and Sarah's case, that's not how it's worked. And now she's way past, there's no human way that this is going to work. God has to make it happen. The promise is because God has to make it happen. And I think that this point about wealth and comfort, when we're no longer dependent on God, it's so easy to miss when he's at work. He may, in fact, be at work. You know, maybe a doctor is successful because they're really good at doctoring, really good at surgery or whatever it is they do. And they could easily think that's because they've got the skill and they've put in the time. And how do we know God's not blessing them and giving them favor? And he gave them the skill, of course. And Psalm 90, establish the work of our hands, O Lord. Like, our work has permanence because God gives it permanence, not because of how good it is that we make it. We can make great things and have them be destroyed. It's God who does this. And so even in our own strength, it's God working. Joseph's now left with, that's all he's got. There's no way he can miss the lesson now. Any other thoughts about this? Abigail, do you have any thoughts about this? Let me ask this final question. What it says that God has steadfast love for Joseph. This is a very key word in the Bible. It's the word hesed. Have you guys heard that word before in Hebrew? Hesed. Whenever you see steadfast love in the Bible, it's usually just one word in Hebrew, hesed, which is it means faithfulness to one's word, faithfulness to one's promise. That's why it's usually translated steadfast love. Like, it's not a love that is spent quickly or easily. God is described as giving Joseph, even in prison, chesed, steadfast love. What does that tell us about the quality of God's chesed? It's not always comfortable, yeah? Woe is the man who has God's steadfast love on him, right? And when God puts his finger on you, it may not mean your life goes well, at least not in every detail. I mean, think about...
It is unfailing.
Yeah, it is unfailing, though. I mean, think about what God's hand on Jeremiah did for Jeremiah's life. Yeah. Think about what God's hand on David meant for David's life. I mean, he spent several years in the desert as a fugitive because of God. That happened as a direct result of what God did for David. And is there any wonder why Jesus says to his disciples, have you not read that the Messiah must first suffer and die and then enter into his glory? Where is he getting this from? How does Jesus know that the hand of God on him means the cross? There's tons of precedent for it in the Old Testament.
I like that God gave it like an act of kindness though to Joseph. Although at the time, it led to strife within his family by giving him those dreams.
Right.
Because in a way, he's saying like, hey, here's the end of the story before you go on the journey. To where I...
One sobering reality about this that is worth paying attention to is that spiritual gifts can be abused. Just because you have a spiritual gift doesn't mean you're using it properly. I mean, do we have any other examples in the scriptures, Old or New Testaments, of somebody having a spiritual gift, which then, or people having a spiritual gifts, which then in their abuse become a source of chaos? Samson? That's an interesting story, yeah. Samson's a very... His narrative confuses me, but that might be a good example of a guy who's just not quite using it the way God intends him to. What else? Jonah, interesting. Yes, also, he abuses the gift. He hears from God, but he ignores God. God's like, uh-huh, nah. Doesn't work that way.
I don't know if this is abuse, but Elisha had some children eaten by bears because they made fun of him.
Yeah, that's a tough one. That's a tough one. I'm looking at the weeds on that one just yet. Yeah. What about the Corinthians? Remember what happened to the Corinthians? Whole three chapters of Paul's first letter to them is about the abuse of spiritual gifts. And they have these great gifts. They have things that we would love, we'd die, we'd kill to see in the modern church. Tongues, healings, all this great miraculous stuff. Sure evidence that like they are with God, they've got it down, like they are in the God's favor, and they are blowing. They're using the spiritual power and they're blowing it. Just the church is divided like crazy. And Paul's like, beside himself with these guys. And he's saying, let me show you a far better way. That's the segue into chapter 13, which is, it's chapters 12 through 14, where Paul is dealing with the abuse of spiritual gifts in the Corinthian church, right smack dab in the center of that. Love is patient, love is kind, love doesn't envy, love doesn't boast. Right, so all the spiritual gifts in the world aren't worth much if it's just for puffing yourself up. God gives us gifts to build up, and we build up in love, right? So one lesson in all this is that if you have some gifting from God, don't assume that because it's from God, there's no way you could use it incorrectly. We see both in the Old Testament and New that that's, we can still blow it. With the gift itself, with even supernatural gift, it's possible. So we need to be sober about it. Like, we have to steward this thing. And all of it is subject to love, because chaos results if we don't. So, again, I think there's a lot in the church and in the world outside, there's a lot of things that could happen that might be seen as marks of divine favor, like material prosperity, success in the work that you're doing, the presence of spiritual gifts, even powerful ones. They may be a sign of God's purpose with you, of God's favor, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're using it right, or that you can't still stumble and fail. The last thing I'll say about this before we adjourn for tonight, because we're over time, is particularly in modern debates in our culture about sexuality, Christians are often accused of a double standard, in part because the Bible seems to allow for polygamy, multiple marriage partners. It's almost certainly the case that the vast majority of the Israelite population didn't have multiple wives, because providing materially for a whole second family is expensive. Most people just couldn't afford that. So the number of people who had multiple wives were probably the elite classes. That's just an economic reality. While the Bible doesn't condemn outright the fact that Jacob takes multiple wives, it doesn't condemn the fact outright that David takes multiple wives, I do think the biblical narratives condemn it. Why? Yeah. He always picks the illegitimate son. He picks the younger wife. It never goes well. I don't know of a single example in the biblical narrative where a man has multiple wives where that doesn't fuel chaos in the narrative that follows. I mean, in David's case, after he becomes king, the fallout between the sons of his multiple wives is the whole rest of the book. It almost destroys his kingdom. Blake.
I just read Genesis 4, where they start giving the genealogy.
Mm-hmm.
And there, the theme of that chapter, I think it's 4, is the increased wickedness.
Right.
In the world, right? And that's where you get Lamech and his killing a man.
Right. Right.
In that genealogy, it's careful to mention that.
Like, he's the first. He's the first.
Point, boom, Lamech takes two wives.
Right, he's the first to do it.
And he's the first to do it. And I think that is an indication.
Yeah.
A subtle one, but that is a sign of the increase.
Yeah. I think that's why when the issue of marriage and divorce comes up in the New Testament, Jesus' recourse is to appeal to Genesis 2. He goes as far back as he can go. Because it's corrupted quickly. Even among God's people, it becomes a source of problems. Now, God is capable of working, nonetheless, through the bad choices that we make. And here we see a profound blessing coming through Joseph, who's, in some sense, the illegitimate son of an illegitimate wife, on the terms of one man, one wife. So the narrative maybe not outright condemn Jacob for this. The narrative doesn't outright condemn David for taking multiple wives. And in some cases, the wives serve them usefully and beneficially in their ministries. But the scripture is always pretty sober-minded about what's going to happen. It's never pretty. I don't know of a single example where there's multiple wives and children from those wives, where the narrative's not explicit that this There's serious discord as a result of all that. So anytime you hear somebody say, well, the Bible allows for polygamy, to say, there's a difference between the Bible telling a story where something happens and the Bible actually allowing for that thing being as a good thing. I mean, the Bible's a lot of just narrative. It just tells you what happened. Just because Jacob took multiple wives doesn't mean God said, go for it, buddy. Right? So just keep that in mind, that the way the Bible conveys truth is not always in that direct manner that we tend to want it to sometimes. I think that the narrative way of describing, oh, you want more than one wife? Okay, well, let me tell you a story about a guy named Jacob and Rachel and Leah and all his sons. It's like, it's more powerful, you know, than just like, well, don't do it, it'll be bad. You know what I mean? Like, right. Yeah, and the New Testament makes that connection for us explicitly. Absolutely. Okay, so next week, we're going to be looking at how Joseph gets out of this particular spot. We're going to look at his rise to power in Egypt. So that's chapters 40 through 41. So just the next two. So if you guys want to read those in advance, that might be helpful. And then the last week we'll deal with the climax of this story, which is actually five chapters. So just read chapters 40 and 41 for next week, and then we'll talk about what happens to Joseph next.